But you're too polite to ask that question, but my sixth graders always do. But the thing that I, thinking about a way of reading, and I probably should have said this at the very beginning, I'm trying to give up reading the Bible for other people and trying to read it for myself. And so you'll kind of have to put up with that a bit. But one of the things when I read the scripture for myself and read it as narrative literature, it's interesting to me what an author or a storyteller keeps repeating. And what is the word that keeps getting repeated? I mean, he must have known that there were Lutherans going to read this sometime, because who were slow learners who wouldn't get what we're talking about here. So he repeats one word more than any other word in the text. It's what?
Brother.
He could have called him Abel over and over again, but he calls him brother. And so the issue gets set right away, it seems to me, in the second verse, next she bore his brother Abel. And so the brother is introduced right at the beginning. Now, I want to go as an anticipation of the rest of the book of Genesis. Can you think of how many stories of brothers? Let's just kind of do a quick review of what we know about the Genesis story. How many brother stories do we have? Let's just name some brothers.
Joseph and
11 brothers.
Okay, so that's what?
Jacob and Esau.
Ishmael and Isaac.
Abraham and Lot.
Lot is his nephew, but he's still in the family, and that's important, okay? Who else?
Well, there's this Noah and his sons, and Noah is the brothers.
That's right. Noah and his sons, and there's important relationships between the different characteristics of between those brothers. Any others? Well, there's a lot. There's some obscure ones, like the sons that are born to Tamar in that strange story in Genesis 38 between Judah and Tamar, and one of them who also have, it's twins born, and one sticks his hand out and they tie a ribbon on it, and then becomes the father or the progenitor of David. There's all kinds of stuff going on in this these texts about these brotherly relationships.
There's a lot of interesting half-brother ones too, because several of these patriarchs had several wives, and so you get Rachel and Bilhah and all these different folks, and then the complicated relationships that happen in their offspring, or who's the rightful heir.
Right. Well, one of the things, this is again in my retirement, I'm going to look at Benjamin. I'm absolutely fascinated by Benjamin. Because when he gets born, his mother names him Son of Sorrow, and his father gives him a distinguished name, Son of the South or Right Hand. And then when we get to Paul in the New Testament, Paul wants to tell us that he's a Benjaminite. And there's a whole history of the tribe of Benjamin, which is utterly fascinating, at least to me. Nobody's salvation rests on the tribe of Benjamin, but I think Paul is trying to redeem him. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. So the thing that I want to look at in this text is the question that we hear often, and probably the most important, or the most certainly well-known question perhaps in the book of Genesis, is, am I my brother's keeper? Am I the shepherd? What's the answer to that? I mean, I think that's kind of what we want to keep open. And another thing I probably should have mentioned at the very early, at the outset of this study, for me, a successful Bible study is if you leave the study with more questions than you came. Because it's only when you have questions that the Bible starts to yield some answers for you. And while I really like my answers, If you went back and listened to the tapes I did years and years ago here at Holden, I'm probably not saying anywhere near the same thing. I hope, anyway, I've learned something. And so the questions are critical, I think, and just to have them and let the, you know, live with the questions that you have about the Bible over years and years, and don't worry about getting an answer right away. So here, the question is, am I my brother's keeper? And then there is this kind of sense, it seems to me, in this text that reflects the brokenness of the society, that whoever was the narrator, the first narrator, and then whoever collected these materials together for the community of faith, wants to get some insight into understanding their world. And so part of their understanding of the world they live in is in terms of its brokenness, where the brother's blood cries out to God from the ground, from the very ground from which Adam was made. And now you are cursed from the ground which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. And so something about the society, the world that we live in, being the world of the author and I think also now of the reader, is that it is this, represents this brokenness that probably wasn't the Creator's intention in the first place.
Charlie, this may be way off base, but it was really striking to me that this is the second time already in these first four chapters that brokenness results in estrangement from the earth, and they'll have to toil the earth and so forth. And in some ways, the two stories mirror the great commandment of love God with heart, soul, mind, love your neighbor as yourself. The first one's estrangement to God with Adam and Eve, and then results with cursed be the ground, and you'll be estranged from the ground, heaven, and so on. And now you have the sin against another person, in this case a brother. But both of them end up with not only human estrangement, but estrangement with the earth. And they come back to back right away in these first two chapters. Interesting.
And I think that's why we read this together. Somebody who's really kind of concerned about environmental things will pick up things that, you know, that's why years ago when I first read Phyllis Trible's text of Terror was for me another place where you really learn what it means when you see scripture from somebody else's eye or through somebody else's eyes and experience. Now I'd like to have you turn to chapter 37, and we're going to skip a whole lot of stuff. I field tested this little study with my Bible study groups at Holy Trinity, and on the Tuesday night group afterwards, my wife told me that was way too detailed. Nobody got anything, so that was overstating a little bit. But so then the next week with the Tuesday morning group, I scaled it back a bit, and we'll see how much that helped. Now here's an interesting question that I pondered for lots of years. Genesis has 50 chapters. 13 of them deal with Joseph and his brothers. Joseph is the primary character, but he literally disappears in the rest of the scripture. He's not the brother in the whole group that the rest of the Old Testament worries about. So for years I've wondered, why in the world does he get 26% of the press in Genesis, and he's not critical as the narrative unfolds in the history of Israel? I'm not sure I'm closer to any answer, but I think, again, this sense about brothers is a way maybe of getting at this. And what I want to do right now is look for a moment at material we all know from Sunday school. We've read this 100 times probably in Sunday school, and because it kind of sets the stage. So Genesis chapter 37. Jacob settled in the land where his father had lived as an alien, the land of Canaan. This is the story of the family of Joseph. I mean of Jacob, excuse me. Then immediately, Joseph, being 17 years old, becomes now the center stage, the central actor in the drama. And so, if I could ask somebody to read the first verses, the 2 through 11. Not all at once.
I'll read it.
All right.
This is the story of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was the helper to the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children, because he was the son of his old age. And he had made him a long robe with sleeves. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all of his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Once Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream that I dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright. When your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more because of his dreams and his words. He had another dream and told it to his brothers, saying, "Look, I have had another dream. The sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." And when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What kind of dream is this that you have had? Shall we indeed come, I and your mother and your brothers, and bow to the ground before you?" So his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind.
Okay, any responses to that reading?
I'm thinking the family would have been happier if Joseph had had a therapist who could have talked with him about his dreams instead of telling the family.
Send him to Chuck, right?
Chuck has new dreams.
All right. So one of the very first things about this is not a good beginning with brothers, right? What do we have in the first case? What's the first thing about Joseph? Thinking of Joseph as brother, he's a what? What did we use? He's a tattletale. Little brother tattletale, right? Okay. What else? What other characteristics of brothers? Brotherliness is present or absent.
He was the favorite.
He was the favorite of his dad. One of the interesting things about Bible characters like us, they're extremely slow learners. And this having favorites is going to be a problem in lots of places. And they seldom learn. Joseph himself doesn't learn, but that's another place when... Another little detail in the text we probably won't get to, with his own sons and who gets the favorite blessing and all that stuff. But anyway, that's somewhere else. Okay, what else about this text? Well, one of the things, reading it as narrative, the plot is given in the dreams, right? And one of the things that I try to teach myself and try to remind myself is to watch the questions. Because it seems to me the narrator is in the questions that are being asked is doing some interesting things about how the plot and how the story is going to turn out. Look for a moment at verse 8. His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to have dominion over us?" And for that reason, they hate him. Now keep that in mind, kind of, for when we get to the end of the story. What is, you know, we can ask ourselves something again that the narrator is not going to tell us at the end of the story about totally the internal feelings of the brothers. Now, the hatred between brothers is introduced in this series of questions and response, but then we have another series of questions and a slightly different response, looking at verse 10. But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What kind of dream is this that you have had? Shall we indeed come, I and your mother and your brothers, and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers now move to jealousy, and Joseph or Jacob, and again, this is something that we're not told, but it may set up making it easier for Jacob to move to Egypt, because he does what Mary does in Luke, right? his father kept this matter in mind. Now, but that, again, the narrator never comes back and says, "Do you remember that I told you back there in chapter 37 that he was going to remember these things?" But at least it probably helps facilitate something about, because a lot of other things are going to happen in between that Jacob needs to keep in mind. All right? Now, the next, let's see, where do we... Well, we'll separate this. If someone would read verses 12 through 24.
Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to him, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word again." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields, and the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I am seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, I pray you, where are they pasturing the flock?" And the man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him afar off, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that a wild beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Cast him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand upon him, that he might rescue him out of their hand, to restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe, the sleeves that he wore, and they took him and cast him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it.
Okay, Eddie, what do you see in this? You know, again, I think it's sometimes helpful when we are doing Bible study, if somebody reads the text, just kind of close your eyes and think like back in the days of radio drama and you're listening to the Lone Ranger or Sergeant Preston or whatever, and just kind of see the images. What kind of images, what kind of pictures come to your mind as we move through this little section?
The intrigue of the plan when he's about miles away, they see him.
Okay. So again, the narrator set up, they see this guy coming. We know he's a tattletale. We also know that he's come out here to check up on us, right? So we're going to fix his little red wagon. Okay. What else?
In chapter 37, you kind of wish somebody would step forward and say, "Well, what does God want us to do in this situation?" Complete absence of any reference. The closest you come is, Reuben says, "Shed no blood." and that's sort of a vague memory somehow, because he's still willing to throw him in the pit.
Yeah, and that's a very, very helpful observation, Joel, I think, in terms of all of this about almost the stage is almost absent of God. And again, that's going to be really, this is really important when we get to the end of things about how we recognize the presence of God as things unfold. Because the text is going to have some clues about that. Okay?
Sorry, this is much less profound than Joel's insight, but I'm thinking sort of the level of family drama, the repeated incident of the robe here with the sleeves. And I'm thinking about in our family, I mean, Christmas was always the nightmare for my parents because inevitably somebody got a present that everybody else envied. And then that child would make sure that she or he wore that all the time to just sort of stew that envy up. I'm really struck by, you know, here Joseph kind of saunters up flaunting the symbol of his father's favoritism there, and then that becomes the symbol that they're going to use against him as well. They strip him of that. But you can just sort of, and I, does it say in the text that it's a coat of many colors? And I always
hear
about it as a coat
of
many
colors. You'll notice where it's introduced, there's a footnote. And it tells you traditional rendering, compare the Greek, a coat of many colors, but the meaning of the Hebrew is uncertain.
Okay.
Bob, do you know anything about that word or the translation of it? Or
I'd have to look in the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
But it adds to my sense of the story, just when you say close your eyes, I can imagine Joseph just walking out with this brilliant robe that everybody hates because it's the father's gift to him, and that's what they're going to strip him from, and sort of symbolically stripping him of his lineage.
Leanne?
Yeah. In 22, the narrator's aside, it seems like Reuben's goodness is more directed out of a love for his father rather than his brother, because he's not going to save him to save Joseph's life, but to restore him to his father.
And as we'll see in a minute, we probably hear we have overlapping traditions. But Reuben is a very interesting character in the story plot, and we don't have time to go through that, but if you look at each of these brothers and then think of the history of their tribe and the role of Reuben, and we could go to Genesis 49, it's almost as if it's forgotten, this incident of Reuben, but that's another story. There's a couple of things, again, I think, because I think a lot of times that narrative works by way of irony. And so we have Joseph wandering around seeking his brothers. Very interesting. Because, and whatever that means, I think we just need to kind of put in the deep recesses of our mind, because this man, whoever this man is, I ask him, what are you seeking? I am seeking my brothers. And then the other kind of thing, when we get to verse 19, we have this deep sense of irony, it seems to me. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that a wild animal has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. The irony is, what if their plot had worked? What would have become of his dreams and of them? Huh? Yeah, if they'd gotten their way, what would have come of his dreams and them? Okay, let's read the rest of this chapter, 25 through 36.
Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, carrying gum, balm, and rosin on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers agreed. When some Midianite traders passed by, they drew Joseph up, lifting him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and where can I turn?" Then they took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They had the long robe with sleeves taken to their father, and they said, "This we have found. See now whether it is your son's robe or not." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. A wild animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters sought to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning." Then his father bewailed him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard.
Okay, what ingredients in the story now are mixed in? What occurs to you here?
Well, the first thing I see is that they sat down to eat, but Joseph was in the pit, so he didn't get anything.
Okay.
Another thing I've noticed here is that in chapter 37, verse 1, it talks about how Jacob settled in the land where his father lived as an alien. And it's like that settling isn't permitted by the narrator because, you know, suddenly you have Joseph who becomes a wanderer, which is kind of like what Cain had been.
Yeah.
You know, and now the brothers, you have this repetition of blood, right? Which, brother's blood, which harkens back to Cain and Abel, you know. And now, you know, the family is clearly scattered. So there's exile, so it looks like fratricide leads to exile.
Okay. All right. A lot of stuff here, huh? What else?
And it's hard to understand how the brothers, seeing their father suffer, how one of them wouldn't say, "Oh, it really isn't true. This is what happened. He is alive." They let him think he was dead.
But here's another place where close attention to the text really yields something. They never tell Jacob that Joseph is dead. They let him jump to his own conclusion. Another irony, this is wonderfully laid out in a book written years ago, Robert Alter's The Art of Biblical Narrative. And because the next question that I'm going to ask and not really answer very much is, what in the world is chapter 38 doing in here? Because we've gotten Joseph down to Egypt with Potiphar's house, and then suddenly we jump to Judah and his little deal with Tamar. Nothing to do with the storyline, seemingly. But as Alter, and this will also become very critical, and we'll see this when we finally get to chapter 45 and beyond, the Hebrew word for recognized is all over the place. And here is the irony, folks. Jacob got the birthright from Esau by deception. And so now he is deceived. And so he doesn't the recognition, you know, Isaac is old and blind and he doesn't recognize things. And now Jacob recognizes something that leads him to the wrong conclusion. I mean, there's kind of no other conclusion possible, but this whole sense about recognition. And this gets back to Joel's observation. One of the things I think the narrator wants us to do is to begin to learn how to recognize God at work in history. And it's sometimes God, as a friend of mine used to say, that God uses crooked sticks to draw straight lines. And here we got a lot of crooked sticks. And how do we recognize God at work in this? Because recognition is what this is all about when we finally get to chapter 45.
Charlie?
Yeah.
I would not have noticed this except you juxtaposed Cain and Abel with this story because it seems very different. I realize, when I back at Cain and Abel, there's no response from Adam or Eve to that murder, I think in the text, right? I mean, God intervenes directly, so we get God's voice in the Adam and Eve story and God's voice in Cain and Abel constantly telling us that it's very different here because God's, as Joel pointed out, sort of really behind the scenes, but you get the strong reaction of Jacob to this deception, murder, and stuff, but it seems like the parents' reaction is simply missing in your story.
Well, I don't know. This is just off the top of my head. The interesting thing, the only response we get to the Cain and Abel story from the parents is to have Seth,
children, yeah,
whom they understand to be a replacement for the son that's gone. Now, what are you going to do with that? I mean, there's probably a way that gets worked out, too, but that's why this is for my retirement where I'm going to work all this stuff. It'll keep me busy 10 years or whatever, just trying to get, I mean, because I think that's, again, an interesting observation about how does the narrator use the response of the parents in this situation. And you see, here's another irony in this text, fascinating ironies in this text. Verse 35, all his sons and his daughters sought to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, no, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning. He's going to go down to Egypt to his son, Jacob is. And notice the next thing that the guy tells us is, well, Joseph is going down all right, but he's going down to Egypt. And lo and behold, finally, Jacob will go down, not in mourning, because it'll be reunion and all that kind of, but so there's irony even in terms of kind of the geography. But there's one other thing, I think, again, that ties this back to the Cain and Abel stuff about blood and all of that. Verse 26, then Judah, now notice Judah, emerged, well, the other before this, who comes along? The Ishmaelites. Our cousins, right? And then they're going to sell, as we're going to see later on, they're going to do some trading to the Midianites. Oh, we're going to be, you know, they're also relatives. And that's where Moses runs when he runs away from Egypt and he marries the Midianite and so on. I mean, and Midian was one of the seven sons of Abraham that we get back. I mean, this stuff gets really convoluted here. But anyway, going back to verse 26, then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? We already know you can't do that because the blood will cry out from the ground, right? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and lay not our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers agree. Now this is full of all kinds, I mean, we've got all kinds of stuff working here, right? And so they sell him and they take Joseph to Egypt. And as I say, there's probably, it looks like, two traditions here, the Reuben tradition and the Judah tradition about how Joseph was saved. And wonderfully, the Bible doesn't worry about this little detail about what happens when Reuben shows up. And he goes kind of berserk over this kind of, the boy is gone, where can I turn? And then they take Joseph's coat. So the very vehicle that expresses the favoritism of the father, which is a problem in the brothers' relationships, is used then to deceive the father. Very interesting irony. Now, we can't go through all the stuff, and you can be thankful for that, I guess, of the story of Joseph. But again, to use Joel's observation, You know, we see hardly at all the hand of God. In fact, when after Joseph interprets the dreams in prison, and never remember whether it's the baker or the butler who lives, gets out and lives 3 years, and then finally went, oh, I remember, I had made a promise to that guy 3 years ago that I was, when I got out, and that I'd remember him, and he's still there in prison. But, and where is God while he waits there? We're not told. But anyway, now we get to chapter 45. The brothers have come.
It's another interesting idea. I can't resist.
No, go. That's what we're here for.
You know, the garment that's used to deceive, I mean, it's Jacob, that's exactly what happened with Isaac, right? Because one thing that's trapped, Esau harbors his hairy, his hairiness and everything. And so he puts on the goat skins to deceive.
Yeah. And he also puts on Esau's garments because they smell.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that Jacob Isaac who cannot see, he says something is really fishy here. It's Jacob's voice, but it's Esau's body and his smell. Yeah. And it's the garment that smells, the text tells us. The Bible, I mean, if it weren't anything else, it's certainly fascinating. I mean,
I'm sort of puzzled because I don't understand why it's not okay for humans to play favorites, but it's okay for God to consistently play favorites. That seems inconsistent to me.
Well, yeah, and I, you know, again, I'm not, I think that's really a valid, very good question. And I think we're going to have to struggle with that whole question. And I think the scriptures do. And I'm going to go a little different place to come at that question. One of my favorite Old Testament scholars is James Sanders, and he has this concept that what you have in the First Testament is this thrusting toward monotheism, and I think we can argue that now another little slightly different digression. I've for years and years taught that what you have in the Bible are what I call biblical or our conversations. The Bible doesn't say the same thing about the same thing all the time. And so what we're invited to do is to get into this. And if God is the creator of all, of everyone and everything, then how can God play favorites? And I think the Bible deals with that question. And I think we get to Paul, let's say, in Galatians 3:28, that's the right verse anyway, the end of the third chapter, that in Christ there's not Jew nor Gentile, male or female, bond or free, but all are one. But that's a thrusting. And so I think they're going to call into question that understanding. You know, the problem, and again, this is probably something I should have said at the very beginning, I spent virtually my whole ministry, again, as I've said several times, as a slow learner trying to figure out the answer to this question about how does the Bible work? You know, how does it, and I'm not sure about that, except that one of the ways it works, I think, is that until it starts to become autobiography for us, and just when we kind of think we've got something settled, we see something over here in Scripture that says, well, I don't know about that. And so it keeps us always also on the move. And I think your point is that it is not okay for God to play favorites. And one of the things that I'm going to argue when we look at this book, Why the Nations Rage, we see why it's necessary to get beyond that concept of God. Because we pay too high a price for God to play favorites.
Okay.
Okay, thank you for the question and putting up with vague answers. Let's read, if we could, the first 15 verses of chapter 45.
Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all those who stood by him. And he cried out, "Send everyone away from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, so dismayed were they at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come closer to me." And they came closer. He said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are 5 more years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not delay. You shall settle in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children, as well as your flocks, your herds, and all that you have. I will provide for you here, since there are 5 more years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have will not come to poverty. And now your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my own mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father how greatly I am honored in Egypt and all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here." Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, while Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. And after that, his brothers talked with him.
All right, any observations anyone wants to share?
Well, it seems that the brothers did the right thing by selling him into slavery. Because if they hadn't done it, then he wouldn't have been able to be where God wants him to be.
Yeah, that's... Again, quoting James Sanders, he argues about reading the Bible theologically rather than moralistically. And since the moral of the story is that by selling our brother into slavery, we have been able to survive as a nation, the moral of that is then we ought to keep selling our brothers into slavery. But of course that's not, I mean, the point of it is that God has used this, in essence, very human, because, again, going back to Joel, God didn't seem to be around in 37. But now the point is that somehow or another God was involved in those events with a redemptive purpose, to use that language, even for the very perpetrators of the crime. Now, I suppose that you might extrapolate that as a statement of grace, huh?
You know, it's an incredibly long spiritual journey for this man. Starting out 37 without any kind of regard for God. And I can't imagine what Joseph's life might have been like for years and years and years in this foreign land with not a very good theology around the table at home. How he gets to this point is astounding. It's like God is very patient and long-suffering with this whole business, and it's a really elaborate plan to fix them, but it would be a painful journey. Yeah.
And particularly for people who live in an instant society like ours. Yeah. You know, what does it mean at the end of one's life to look back?
Figure it out.
Rather than in the, you know, and we want to do it in the last 15 minutes or whatever. And so this kind of long view of things.
I guess the thing that strikes me, especially after last night's texts, was the brothers expect vengeance when Joseph's identity is discovered, but what he responds with is mercy.
Yeah.
And the mercy creates reconciliation, creates community, family.
And they figure they deserve it, too. I mean, there's nothing in there about, he's going to be rotten to us, we better jump first, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They deserve it, they know.
Well, and going back just one more step, again, just to throw all this in the mix and not try to resolve anything, it's always hard to know where in a study like this to jump in. But look for a moment, let your eyes look at the verse just before chapter 45. What the issue is here, and this is Judah speaking, and that's not probably accidental, since Judah is going to be us as the land of Judah. But it says, "For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me?" And this is Benjamin. "I fear to see the suffering that would come upon my father." And who has inflicted this great suffering in the first place? The very speaker of these words, Judah. He's the one that cooked the plan to sell him into Egypt. I mean, there's just, again, wonderful play here. This recitation that we don't really need to go into very much more because I want to go to another place, but notice again, I like to think that the biblical narrator knew that folks like us would show up, and so they keep repeating the theological message here, verse 5, and "Now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." And then verse 8, "So it was not you who sent me here, but God." Verse 9, "God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me and do not delay." And then a very important verse 11, "I will provide for you there, since there are 5 more years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have will not come to poverty." I will provide for you. Am I my brother's keeper? Now let's go to chapter 50. And this, I love this. This is, now we're coming to the end of the story. We've had all this stuff about Joseph saying, "Don't sweat the path. It was God's intention. It'll be just fine." Now Jacob dies. And you know what happens when the parent dies? Because, you know, we've been worried about what Papa thinks. Well, Papa's pushing daisies now. And so we're down in the church basement afterwards, and we've got unfinished business. I just absolutely love this. So if someone would read for us verses 15 through 21.
Realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brothers said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong that we did to him?" So they approached Joseph, saying, "Your father gave this instruction before he died. Say to Joseph, I beg you, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. Now, therefore, please forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also wept, fell down before him, and said, "We are here as your slaves." But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good, in order to preserve a numerous people, as he is doing today. So have no fear. I myself will provide for you and your little ones." In this way, he reassured them, speaking kindly to them.
So how would you answer the question, am I in the place of God?
Yeah.
I think the answer is yes. Am I my brother's keeper? Am I in the place of God? Yes. For the provision of life. So anyway, we were told that we're supposed to be no more than an hour long, so we'll kind of leave it at that point. But it's kind of fascinating, I think, when you see how this story begins and comes now to this place. In terms of the relationship with brothers. And there's a whole lot of other stuff I wish we had time to get into, wonderfully delicious stories about brothers and families and sisters. And one that I particularly love, and of course, is the story of Lot and his two daughters when they escape from Sodom and they get the old man drunk on consecutive nights. And they give birth to Moab and to Ammon. So the Moabites and the Ammonites, and you know, they're basically calling them bastards in one sense, but they're our cousins. And then of course the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Edomites, who always show up on the list of our enemies. They're always on the list of our enemies. And then we have the book of Ruth. Four chapters long, 13 times, we're told she's a Moabitess. I mean, how do you... And then we're told that she is the great-grandmother of David. And then we have the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, which says, never marry a foreign woman. That's all in the Bible, folks. It's all working there together. And it seems to me that we forget this most basic beginning of the story about being deeply related at our own peril. And that's why I want to suggest and recommend this book. This book was written in January of 97. It's about the Balkans. Mm-hmm. It's written by an Englishman who writes as a Christian and it was written when Bosnia was the big issue. But I just want to read just a very short little thing from this book. One of the guys in my Bible study class had checked this out at the public library in Port Angeles, and so he gave it to me to read, and I thought, man, this helps make my point, plus it gives me a little understanding about the present situation in the former Yugoslavia. What is interesting is that if you trace back far enough, the actual ethnic distinctions between Serb, Croat, and Bosnian are all very small. Until the Civil War began, the official language was called Serbo-Croat. The difference between the languages spoken in, say, Zagreb, Sarajevo, and Belgrade were fairly minimal, maybe even less than that between British English and American English, and certainly not as great as the difference between German and Dutch. Nowadays, this has changed. Newly independent regimes are emphasizing the difference in language, seeing Croatian and Bosnian as distinct, separate and independent languages. It is probable that as time passes and as political divisions continue, the distinctions between languages will increase. Unfortunately, language like history has become a political football, with thousands of people dying as a result. One's dialect or language indicates one's nationality. During a civil war, dialect may identify certain people as belonging to the enemy and mark them out for death. We have shibboleths, right? Whether you could cross the Jordan River or not, if you pronounce the SH or the S. This book really is wonderfully insightful about what happens when you merge religious and national identities. To be a Serb is to be an Eastern Orthodox Christian. To be a Croat is to be a Roman Catholic Christian. Tito is the one who made Bosnian Muslims. They're the the largest minority in Bosnia. And the person also stresses, I mean, goes through a lot of kind of things about how we as Americans, for me to say I'm an American and I'm a Lutheran, gets way down the connection between that are pretty tenuous. But his sense about what that means in Northern Ireland and some other, I mean, it really is fascinating. And like, he goes in to become very critical of us as Christians when the people in Rwanda, the Tutsis and the Hutus are all Christian. And anyway, interesting stuff that I think has some connection with the Genesis. So we'll close, and there's obviously a lot of time for other discussion, and we'll just let them shut the tape off, and then we can visit beyond that. So if anybody has any questions or comments. Or